And you won't take a cold shower or imagine your significant other as Joy Behar or Carrot Top instead, I've got some parenting advice for you. Of course, I am fully aware that my wife is the brains of the parenting operation, and I'm little more than a flesh-and-bone jungle gym and entertainment system. But here's what I've gleaned so far from my job as Super Dad. 1. The Goo-Goo Years. Duty. I know there are two Spocks. One was the baby guy that was writing stuff, and the other was a Vulcan. He was great. Unfortunately for my kids, I only know the Vulcan. Most of my formal education on parenthood came from best-selling books by comedians. Parenthood by Paul Reiser, that was great. Fatherhood by Bill Cosby, I got through almost half of it, and I laughed a lot. The nice part about books, like those, is they don't dwell on the small stuff, such as whether the baby should sleep on its back or stomach, or, you know, when do you feed it? No, they get right to the point. Infants mean poop. Tears and poop. Constantly. Poop, tears, more poop, more tears. When a baby stops crying, it's only because they're getting ready to poop. And then they start crying again, about to poop. No one's ever really prepared for this. There's too much poop. Nor is anyone prepared for how much control an infant has over your life. It makes me want to poop. Considering how small and utterly helpless it is, an infant is totally dependent on you. Yet, it's also the boss of you. It's not right. And then there's poop. 2. The toddler years. Danger, danger, danger everywhere. Assuming the DOP did its job and you were a competent parent who actually fed your child properly, didn't leave it in the sun, didn't sell it to gypsies. Holy cow, you can do that. You'll wind up with a toddler. The good thing about raising toddlers is this. You haven't completely wrecked them yet. You haven't even gotten started. Your little progeny is like a little uncarved stone. An uncarved stone that poops and smells like poop. But an uncarved stone, nonetheless. It's just waiting for you to sculpt it with your parenting savvy as the chisel. Just a disclaimer, our attorneys have recommended that I point out at this point, please don't use a real chisel. The best piece of advice I can give you about raising a toddler is to think of it like a tiny little danger magnet. A lot of people say that children are actually a lot more harmless than you think, that they're almost indestructible. I like to tell you right now that these people are dead wrong. Once toddlers start walking, oh, they'll gravitate towards anything that is remotely dangerous. Items that most people would never even think of as hazardous suddenly take on a new meaning. Get that chiclet out of here! What are you thinking of, man? From the moment these children wake up in the morning until the moment they fall asleep, they're only thinking one thing.
Gee, I wonder what the best way to hurt myself would be.
Michael J. Fox once said that as soon as a child starts walking, the parents are on suicide watch for the next couple of years. He's right. He is. As a parent of a toddler, your mission is very simple. Keep them alive. Sure, it's also nice to clean up their poop, read them maybe a bedtime story here or there, like they're ever going to remember that, and feed them on occasion, but this is all secondary to keeping them poison-free and unelectrocuted. The real fun begins in a few years, when those uncarved stones turn into teenagers. Help, help. Help me. That's when you finally begin to see the fruits of your incompetence. What once was a little bundle of joy is now a pimpled, sarcastic drama bot who wants you to know how unimportant you are in his or her life. A toddler calling you names is funny. A 13-year-old? Not so much. 3. Teens. I don't think they're human. Anything you can say can and will be used against you. It's what all suspects hear when they're arrested. It's also a fact about parenting teens. I know I'm going to pay for everything I say to my kids. It could be 3 years later, it could be 20. But even as the words are coming out of my mouth, I can hear Dr. Makes-a-Lot's cash register ringing 20 years in the future after my kid just spent 45 minutes on his couch.
Then Daddy said, cha-ching. Then I remember my father saying, cha-ching.
That cha-chinging gets especially loud and frequent when you're the father of a teenage girl. Or in my case, two of them, with another one about a dozen years away. It's as if I'm being punked for three straight decades. Only there's no hope of a B-list actor jumping out at the end and telling me it was a big joke. Just the Reaper. For me, the fun of raising my daughters began during the era I like to call the trifecta of awkwardness. The bras, the tampons, the boyfriends. The first two issues I can easily pass off to Mom.
I don't know about this stuff.
After all, I don't know how to put a bra on. And frankly, tampons scare the hell out of me. No man needs to contend with those things. But boyfriends? Oh, yes, that's all mine. Unfortunately, having been one, I know boys. I know how they think. I know what they think about. I know how they operate. I know how they lie. And at the risk of being labeled a reverse sexist, I know all boys are bad. I tried to relay the information to my girls during the infamous preemptive talk. Oof, that was painful. For them, not for me. I mean, it was for me, but much worse for them. It was the birds and bees things, sure, but I went off onto tangents and involved too many bad analogies. There were birds and bees, and then I think there were some wolves and snakes, and then Zeus was watching their every move with a lightning bolt ready. It was ugly. There were clowns, Big Brother, witches, something about a shamed koala named Dooley, and how many years I cleaned up their poop. It didn't go well. For a while afterward, I thought my speech had been so awkward and so convoluted that it might have actually worked. Maybe my daughters would just forget the whole dating idea and become nuns or volunteer for a women-only mission to Mars. Or perhaps they'd enter a loveless, sexless marriage for the sake of their political careers. I don't know. It would have been fine with me. Then it happened.
Dad?
Yeah?
I'm going out tonight.
Pardon me?
You know, with Stanley.
Names have been changed to protect those pretending to be innocent. I'm sitting there thinking, breathe. Breathe, Glenn. Deep breaths. That's right. Nice and slow. Find a happy place. Find your happy place. Pretty birds. Pretty birds. Look at all the pretty birds. Sorry, flashback. After the smelling salts were administered by my wife, I woke up from my unplanned nap there on the floor, caused by hearing that sentence.
I'm gonna start dating.
I started planning. Fortunately, my line of work has allowed me to get to know certain people. People who can take care of things, if you know what I mean, eh? I know, you're probably thinking Kim Caldwell from American Idol, or Danny Bonaducci. Actually, I'm talking about John Walsh from America's Most Wanted. This is great. John and I don't know each other that well, but he's been on my television show and radio show, and I figured, you know, that was more than enough of a friendship to ask him for his help on something very important. So I pitched him my plan, and he agreed. When my daughter's date came to pick her up, I answered the door with my best tough parent act. I said, "Hello, Stanley. Could I have a word with you alone, please?" He didn't know. It was a rhetorical question. He sat down on the couch, and I did an old lawyer trick, which is to sit in silence and stare. The idea? To unnerve the other person into saying something. But I didn't want poor Stanley to say anything, though. I just wanted him to be unnerved. Once the atmosphere was sufficiently uncomfortable, I leaned forward, and in a friendly but scary tone of a mafia warning, I smiled and said the following. "You know that guy, John Walsh, from the show America's Most Wanted?"
"Yes."
"He wanted me to tell you something. I'm trying to remember what it was. I talked to him today. Oh, I remember. He wanted me to tell you that I have a gun, a shovel, lots of property, you'll never be missed, and he'll never put my face on television. Have her back by 8, Stanley." Needless to say, the romance between my daughter and Stanley, darn my luck, never blossomed.
Perhaps they lacked a spark. Or perhaps it was because I threatened to set him on fire. I guess I'll never really know. Now maybe you're starting to understand why I think I'm screwing up my kids so bad. My solution? I mean, come on, if you're seriously looking to me for a solution on parenting, we're in bigger trouble as a country than I thought. You know, I came up with a licensing thing. That's it. I'm out. I got nothing else. What I've learned, though, is that there is no manual for bringing up children the right way. Every day is a new adventure. Every night, a torturous battle between you and your wife to determine who gets up next. In the meantime, all you can really do is love your kids. Listen to them, even the ugly one, and pray that insurance will cover the Prozac. Section 14. Illegal Immigration. Behind the Lies. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The wretched refuse of your teeming shore, send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Those spine-chilling words by Emma Lazarus, engraved onto a plaque on the Statue of Liberty's pedestal, have greeted immigrants to America for generations, boat after boat, decade after decade, from country after country. They've come here to make a better life for themselves and their families. They are our great-grandfathers, our grandmothers, our uncles and parents. They are our teachers, our doctors, our scientists, and our leaders. They brought with them new ideas, old traditions, and fresh perspective. America is not just better because of them. America is America because of them. This section is not about those people. Let me make something clear right off the top. People who want this country to secure its borders are not racists, nor are they bigots, hate-mongers, xenophobes, or un-American. Yes, I have been called every single one of those things multiple times. There is a difference between the law-abiding Ellis Island immigrants and those who come here in the dark of night, slip into the shadows, but it is not the color of their skin. Honestly, I wish this whole illegal immigration debate was as simple as racism and the big bad conservatives hating minorities. Please finish listening to the sentence before the blog alerts go out, will you? Because then this issue would have been solved a long time ago. Unfortunately, the reality is it's so much more complicated than that, and many of the people who want to make this about racism actually have far different intentions from what you might imagine. Thousands of Mexicans illegally cross U.S. border each month. It's probably not surprising where that headline was published, the Los Angeles Times. But what may be surprising is when it was published, 1950. President after president, Democrat, Republican alike, they all, with varying degrees of public embarrassment, failed to stop the flow and fix the problem. Jimmy Carter wanted to give illegals amnesty, but he didn't have the votes. Ronald Reagan had the votes and required employers to pay large fines for hiring illegals, but he also gave amnesty to millions, and that did nothing to stem the flow. George H.W. Bush opened the front door wider by increasing the level of legal immigration by 35%, but did nothing about the illegal side. Bill Clinton tried to focus on border security and started building a fence. Yeah. And George W. Bush made the fence a little longer. But neither was ever really serious about doing it right. But none of them, including three two-term presidents with nothing left to lose, was able to use his power to solve this once and for all. None of them. Despite leading a Congress where they held the majority of both houses, along with the will of the people, sealed the border, or addressed the fate of millions of illegals already in the country, you have to ask yourself why. While countless pages have been written about the who, what, where, and when of illegal immigration, from the massive security concerns to the impact on our economy to the loss of our nation's identity, the question of why has gone largely unanswered.
After countless hours of research, numerous interviews with experts, and a little bit of logical thinking thrown in for good measure, I believe I finally have the answer. And by the end of this section, so will you. Let's start with a few of the excuses that you've heard a thousand times. Our borders aren't sealed because the Republicans cater to the big businesses that fund their campaigns and demand access to cheap labor.
Yeah, our borders aren't sealed because the Democrats cater to Hispanic American voters, a group with significant influence on election.
Our borders aren't sealed because some of the terrain makes it simply impossible or too costly to build a fence there. Our borders aren't sealed because of the special interest groups that frighten politicians and public alike with calls of racism, you racist.
Every one of those explanations contains a kernel of truth, which is why they're so convincing. But think about it. Are any of those reasons really enough to prevent generation after generation of our leaders from getting together and doing something that vast majorities of the American public support? Politicians literally live and die by poll numbers, right? Why would they choose to ignore their guidance on only this one issue? They wouldn't, unless the politicians themselves aren't really the ones in control.
Oh, and this is why I paid for the book. I gotta get down to my basement. I gotta turn this one up. Oh, here it is. Conspiracy time.
Well, not really. Let me introduce you to some other facts, ones that you probably haven't heard a thousand times before. On March 13th, 2005, U.S. Commerce Secretary Carlos M. Gutierrez met with Mexican Secretary of Economy Fernando Canales and Canadian Privy Council Assistant Secretary Phil Ventura. 10 days later, at a trilateral summit in Waco, Texas, the leaders of Mexico, the United States, and Canada announced the formation of the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America, or the SPP. Here's how it was described that day by Canadian Prime Minister Paul Martin.
The world is not standing still. New economic powerhouses such as China and India are rising, and we need to face new opportunities. But we also face new challenges, and this requires a new partnership, stronger, more dynamic, one that's focused on the future. We're determined to forge the next generation of our continent's success. That's our destination. The Security and Prosperity Partnership that we are launching today is the roadmap to getting there.
Wow. The destination is the next generation of North America's success, and the SPP is the roadmap. That certainly makes it sound like it's a pretty important initiative, huh? But if it's so important, why is it so secret?
I knew it. Conspiracy. Mom, turn down the TV. I'm listening to a CD down here. Go ahead.
There doesn't appear to be any law authorizing the creation or funding of the SPP, and no congressional committee has any oversight of its activities. Many congressmen, and I've talked to a lot of them, don't even know that the SPP exists, let alone the fact that it's already formed numerous working groups that are reporting serious recommendations to cabinet-level executives in all three countries. Now, before the Paranoia Express gets too far from the station,
oh, don't harsh my mellow, man.
Let me disappoint the staged moon landing crowd.
Oh, come on.
And make it clear that I don't believe the SPP is masquerading as some sort of unified North American government. Yet.
Oh, thank you.
But I certainly do believe that Mexamerica Canada could easily evolve over time. Think of the SPP as a trial balloon. If all the readings come back positive, or nobody really pays any attention and cares, then the real work gets underway. Howard Phillips, the chairman of the Conservative Caucus and a major SPP critic, seems to share my concerns. He likens the SPP to the initial stages taken by the supporters of the European Union, saying that the, quote, economic route being pursued behind closed doors by SPP working groups is a replay of the exact stealth route taken in Europe. By leading with economics SPP is crafting a North American regulatory structure that transforms U.S. regulations by harmonizing them with Mexican and Canadian regulations, all without specific congressional approval, end quote. If he is right, if leaders in each of the three countries are hoping that SPP-initiated economic reforms will whet each country's appetite for integration in other areas, then everything the SPP is doing has to be examined under that light. And it all starts with those SPP working groups that Phillips mentioned. Just 90 days after it was formed, the SPP released its first report to leaders. If only official government agencies could work that fast. It announced the creation of 10 working groups that would identify, quote, concrete forward-looking strategies and initiatives, end quote. Ironically, one of those working groups' first recommendations was to create a new working group called the North American Competitiveness Council. And here is how they described it. Quote, you asked us to examine ways to strengthen the SPP to ensure its continuity and success. To that end, ministers officially launched the North American Competitiveness Council, NACC. Our three governments recognize that private sector involvement is key to enhancing North America's competitive position in global markets and is the driving force behind innovation and growth. As such, the creation of the NACC provides a voice and a formal role for the private sector, end quote. Ah, yes, the private sector. You remember earlier when I suggested that it may not be the politicians who are fully in control? Well, I'm not saying that the elite corporate leaders are, but I'm not saying it either. The NACC membership list reads like the guest list of a Fifth Avenue Christmas party that I'll never be invited to. Joseph Gilmore, New York Life. William Clay Ford, Ford. Rick Wagner, General Motors. Raymond Gilmartin, Merck. David O'Reilly, Chevron. Jeffrey Immelt, General Electric. H. Lee Scott, Walmart. Robert Stevens, Lockheed Martin. Douglas Conant, Campbell's Soup. James Kiltz, Gillette. Herman Cain, Whirlpool. That's just a sample of the U.S. participants. The participants from the Canadian and Mexican business communities are equally as impressive. Again, I hate to spoil the party, but is anybody bothering to ask why? What is the point of bringing so many wealthy, influential, and powerful people together under the guise of some working group? I believe there are two answers, and they were both provided to us right in that first report to leaders. Continuity and success. Speaking at the official launch of the NACC, Commerce Secretary Gutierrez pretty much confirmed the continuity aspect. Listen to this, quote, the purpose of this meeting was to institutionalize the North American Security and Prosperity Partnership, SPP, and the NACC, so that the work will continue through changes in administrations. Wow. I guess that makes sense. I mean, if you're planning to be the founding father of a brand new continental government, you gotta make sure it has time to evolve. You can't let those pesky popular elections get in the way of progress. The success element of the NACC's involvement is harder to gauge, mainly because of the secretiveness surrounding all of it. The mainstream media have either ignored this problem or have been largely kept in the dark about it all. And the only real account of the NACC's work can be found in an expose done by a reporter for Maclean's. Isn't that the chick magazine that I think my mom used to read? This woman spoke to some of the participants of the NACC's first meeting. She wrote that the government leaders in attendance asked participants for help in overcoming the bottlenecks, quote-unquote, created by all of those annoying laws and regulations that our elected representatives passed on our behalf.
In her article, she described the group as a cherry-picked group of executives who were whisked to Cancun in March by the leaders of Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, and asked to come up with a plan for taking North American integration beyond NAFTA.
That sounds good, huh?
According to Ron Covey's, president of the Americas for Lockheed Martin, which happens to be the largest weapons manufacturer in the world, quote, the guidance from the ministers was to tell us what we need to do and we'll make it happen. We've decided not to recommend anything that would require legislative changes because we won't get anywhere, end quote. Good thinking, Ron. I mean, we certainly wouldn't want any of those pesky checks and balances mandated in our Constitution to slow you down. Annette Verschuren, president of Home Depot Canada, also seemed to have a good time in the sun and sand of Cancun. She said the meeting was, quote, an intimate discussion and a lot of fun because there were no reporters, just a freewheeling discussion of things that drive you crazy, end quote. Oh man, I wish I had a margarita right now. Oh, nobody really knows exactly what the group is up to, which is exactly the problem. But the chair of the Canadian contingent, Linda Hasenfratz, CEO of auto parts maker Linamar, summed up the plan pretty plainly. Quote, let's get some low-hanging fruit to give the thing some momentum, but let's not lose sight of bigger ticket items. I guess the people who believe the things you hear a thousand times would probably think she's referring to bigger ticket items such as new trade agreements or reduced tariffs. But if you'd hop aboard the Paranoia Express with me for a second,
all aboard!
I'd like to remind you that the whole reason this group exists is to advise our leaders how to take North American integration beyond NAFTA. Call me crazy, but I don't think she's talking about better shipping rates for vegetable trucks. If you don't have your tin hat on yet,
well, wait a minute, I'm just fashioning the foil now.
Please get it ready.
I'm almost ready.
Because we're about to take another step right down the rabbit hole.
Oh, Mom. Mom! I'll be gone for a minute.
As I said earlier, I don't believe the SPP itself is meant to be the new North American government. As secretive as it is, it's still a government program, which means that such things as freedom of information requests can cramp their style a little bit. The NACC, as a roundtable working group, solves some of those problems. But to make real progress, you need to have the private organizations on board. They can create blueprints and roadmaps with almost no public scrutiny, thereby providing an invisible barrier to accountability for any controversial recommendations, barriers that elite government officials are quite fond of. Enter the Council on Foreign Relations.
Aw, Mom. Mommy's going to do it. He's going to talk about the CFR. Oh, I love this part. I love this part.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of acronyms to remember. This one was founded in 1921. The CFR is a, quote, nonpartisan and independent membership organization that has counted some of the nation's most powerful and influential people as members. Current membership is said to include Dick Cheney, Fred Thompson, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, George Soros, Jimmy Carter, and many others. The group claims to be dedicated to the belief that the nation's peace and prosperity is firmly linked to that of the rest of the world. But many believe their true agenda is quite a bit more far-reaching. The late Georgetown history professor Carol Quigley, who Bill Clinton said was his mentor and a major influence in his life, wrote the following in his book Tragedy and Hope. The Council on Foreign Relations is the American branch of a society which originated in England and believes national boundaries should be obliterated and one world rule established, end quote. By the way, he was a fan of the CFR. The CFR has been a target of suspicion from a New World Order crowd for decades. But instead of reciting all of those suspicions, I want to focus on something more recent and relevant to the idea of a North American Union. In 2005, the CFR released a report titled Building a North American Community, written by a CFR-sponsored independent task force. The report was vice-chaired by Professor Robert Pastor. Remember that name.
Oh, is there going to be a CFR test later? Oh, please say yes, please say yes, please say yes.
Its findings were presented to Congress. Why is this report important? Because the report's introduction confirms, the task force is pleased to provide, I'm quoting, specific advice on how the SPP can be pursued and realized. Translated, it means this independent report is directly connected to the SPP, and that the people behind the SPP will ostensibly be looking at the report's findings as a roadmap for the future. The report is 70 pages long. But it all basically comes down to one major recommendation. Quote, the task force proposes the creation by 2010 of a North American community to enhance security, prosperity, and opportunity. Its boundaries will be defined by a common external tariff and an outer security perimeter within which the movement of people, products, and capital will be legal, orderly, and safe. Its goal will be to guarantee a free, secure, just, and prosperous North America. I don't know about you, but when something that unbelievably arrogant and threatening is supposed to be used as a blueprint by a government program, alarm bells start going off in my head.
Oh, they've been going off in my head for a long, long time. Do you hear voices too?
Of course, being paranoid isn't exactly a new phenomenon for me. So the real question is whether any of the report's recommendations will actually be taken seriously. Unfortunately, the answer is yes. In fact, they already have. I want you to know here, all the research done on this chapter was done by a guy who didn't believe me at first. Oh, he believes it now. The report recommended the creation of a, quote, North American Advisory Council that should be composed of eminent persons from outside the government to provide a public voice for North America along the lines of the Bilderberg conferences.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
ADD moment here. I'm mentioning Bilderberg, one of the most secretive gatherings of elite power brokers in the world. It didn't really help their chances with the black helicopter crowd. Why not just throw in a Bohemian Grove reference while you're at it?
All right. Sure, the name is off by one word, but the North American Competitiveness Council was launched by the SPP less than 1 year after the report was released. The report called The Freer Flow of People Within North America. You don't really have to worry about illegal immigration if no one's illegal or an immigrant anymore, do you? Lots of great progress on this one. The government is working to start a pilot program which will allow Mexican trucks to travel freely in the United States for the first time in 25 years. Oh my goodness, and it's already begun. And it's fostering private concerns that are looking into build a NAFTA superhighway running from Mexico through the United States into Canada. Government officials, of course, say they have what? Plans? What are you talking? Plans for a superhighway? I don't even know what you're talking about. Yet the North American Super Corridor Coalition, or NASCO, has received $2.5 million in earmarks from the U.S. Department of Transportation. What? That's just, I don't. Huh? There are plenty of other examples of recommendations made in the CFR report that the government and the SPP have subsequently acted on, air travel, energy, disease outbreaks. But the real question shouldn't be if they're following the CFR's roadmap, but how far they will go. Pop quiz.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, give me a pop quiz. Name the person I mentioned earlier as the vice chair of the task force that authored the CFR report. If you're part of what he calls the xenophobic or frightened right wing of America that is afraid of immigration and globalization, those are his words, then you probably remember his name well, Robert Pastor. When he's not promoting a continental government or following the playbook by equating border security conservatives with racists, Robert Pastor is a professor of international relations at American University. And yes, I do see the tremendous irony in that one. As one of the country's foremost experts on North American integration, Pastor was called on by both the Canadian Parliament and subcommittee of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee to talk about the CFR report. Although he consistently asserts that these conspiracy theorists, they're nut jobs, and quote, nobody is proposing a North American Union. What? His comments in Canada certainly seem to indicate, a little bit otherwise. Quote, the three governments remain zealous defenders of an aging conception of sovereignty, whereas the people seem ready to entertain new approaches, end quote. I'll give you time. Let that wash over you for a while. An aging conception of sovereignty? You mean like we have our own constitution and borders and government and stuff? If so, then I guess I'm one of those zealous defenders, you know. And by the way, you don't have to make any conspiratorial leaps of faith to figure out what he meant by our new approaches, since he covered a few of them right there in that same speech. Here's what he proposed. Give him money. Quote, a North American investment fund to invest $20 billion a year for a decade in infrastructure, roads, ports, railroads, communication, to connect the southern part of Mexico with the lucrative North American market. Protect them. Quote, the Department of Homeland Security should expand its mission to include continental security. I gotta tell ya, I don't want the government involved in continental breakfasts, let alone continental security. Then he goes on, new roads, new rails. Quote, develop an integrated continental plan for transportation and infrastructure that includes new North American highways and high-speed rail corridors. Next, we're all North Americans, you know. Quote, instead of stopping North Americans on the borders, we ought to provide them with a secure, biometric border pass that would ease transit across the border, kind of like an easy pass permits our cars to speed through those toll booths. Change our laws. Quote, the United States and Canada should begin to merge immigration and refugee policies, end quote. I gotta tell you, all great ideas, Bob. Thanks for stopping by. What a frickin' moron. I can definitely see why you say that people are crazy for thinking that you're advocating any kind of North American Union, because that didn't seem like, holy cow, are we in trouble. Pastor ended his testimony in Canada with some brown nosing and a plea. Quote, Canada has played a key leadership role in so many issues. I sincerely hope your government will take the lead in defining the path towards a more collaborative relationship. I cannot say that the United States government will respond positively, but I think Mexico would consider such an approach positively, and if the two neighbors of the United States were to make a persuasive case, influential sectors in the United States would encourage the administration to take them very seriously. Holy cow, does that sound like blackmail? We've covered a couple of those influential sectors already, but there's one more group that you need to be aware of, and Pastor is the key link between them. Don't let its boring name fool you. The North American Forum. NAF. It's an unbelievably secretive group of extremely high-level elites. It's also, according to U.S. Consul General John Ney, a sister organization and parallel structure to the SPP. You probably won't be surprised to hear that no public records are kept and no announcements have been made about the group's activities. The NAF's 2006 meeting at the Banff Springs Hotel in Alberta, Canada, was kept quiet. But at least one participant, who felt that the meeting was an affront to democracy, leaked the guest list and the agenda. It turns out about one-third of those on the task force that wrote the CFR report were invited. What a weird coincidence. And the other two names that should also ring a bell, our friend Robert Pastor, who served on the panel titled A Vision for North America, Issues and Options, and Ron Covace, the Lockheed Martin America's president, who is also a member of the NACC. Of course, there were also numerous other high-level politicians, executives, and military personnel in attendance. The North American Forum. Sure, it's a catchy name and all, but it's a little generic, don't you think? How about something that's a little more clear? I suggest the really rich people who designed the world's future in secrecy while eating free continental breakfast forum. What do you think? If nothing else, the NAF is smart about its secrecy. Members make donations to fund the meeting. Everyone pays for their own travel arrangements. That makes it a private event that no one, including politicians who attend, are mandated to announce publicly. John Larson, an NAF spokesman, tried to explain the private nature of the forum, and I think he just made things worse. He said, quote, "You can imagine that if all of this were televised or open to public scrutiny, the nature of the conversations and ultimately what you'd be able to do with those conversations and how far you might be able to advance the solutions around it would be different." Right. Isn't that sort of the point? The people who believe that the North American Union is nothing but a drummed-up conspiracy theory don't hold back their vitriol for people like me. Michael Medved, a conservative talk radio host and somebody I generally agree with, is one of those people. In a column blasting those who fear an EU-style union for North America, Medved was extraordinarily creative with his insults. I've put them in alphabetical order for your convenience. Remember, he used all of these in the same article. I mean, this takes talent. Bastards, brain-dead fantasies, charlatans, childish, cranks, creeps, crooks, demagogues, drunks, exploiters, fringies, groundless frenzy, hysterics, ill-informed, jerks, jugheads, losers, ludicrous, lunatics, manipulative, miserable cretins, opportunists, paranoid, psychotics, and reprobates. It reads like a definition of me. Elitists are also capitalists, and none of this would be happening if money and profit weren't at stake. For Canada, it's having increased access to the huge American market. For remember, that's what we are. No longer a country, a market. For Mexico, it's increasing its standard of living through trade and more flexible immigration policies. And for the United States, it's mostly about energy. Remember, Canada and Mexico are this country's top two suppliers of oil. Then again, that shouldn't come as much of a surprise to anybody who's actually been paying attention. The now infamous Waco summit, where the SPP was set up, President Bush, standing next to President Fox and Prime Minister Martin, said, quote, "Yes, we're using a lot of energy, and we need to conserve better in the United States. We appreciate the fact that Canada's tar sands are now becoming economical, and we're glad to be able to get the access towards 1 million barrels a day, headed towards 2 million barrels a day. That's, by the way, an advantage for open trade. The American people must understand that when there's open trade, it helps solve our energy deficiency."
Now let me go see Laura.
Maybe everybody is so focused on a so-called war for oil happening overseas that we're all missing the sovereignty for oil trade that is happening right now in front of our eyes. But it goes deeper than oil and profits. The people who support a North American Union also support a common currency. Our friend, Robert Pastor, is one of them. Of course, so is someone a little more influential. Bank of Canada Governor David Dodge. He said that it was possible that North America might one day welcome a single currency modeled after the euro. Welcome to the Amero. I'm not kidding. I actually wish I was. It was originally proposed in a 1999 report by a Canadian think tank to counterbalance the euro. The Amero idea picked up some steam over the years, along with an endorsement from our good friend Robert Pastor. This guy just won't go away. Last year on CNBC, an international currency trader broached the subject on national TV, resulting in the hosts coming back the next day and laughing. He was crazy. I didn't even know what he was talking. Help us. The black van's pulled up front. Unfortunately, they probably should stop laughing and start researching. The Amero may seem like some wild pie-in-the-sky scheme now, but you probably would have said the same thing if I would have told you 15 or 20 years ago that countries such as Germany, France, Ireland, Italy, and Spain would all be using the same currency. Laughing at the idea is exactly what they want, because evolution by stealth is exactly what they crave. My solution. I started by asking a simple question about illegal immigration. Why? Why has no leader bothered to solve the problem once and for all? Why does a Republican president ignore his base and fight for amnesty for millions of illegal aliens? Why? The question is simple, but as you have seen, the answer is anything but. Super elites in our government are conspiring to sell out our sovereignty by skirting around the series of checks and balances mandated by our Constitution. A series that our forefathers set up to prevent this exact scenario from happening. I want to reiterate, I do not believe that the SPP is already masquerading as some North American Union government. In fact, I don't even believe that most people involved in the SPP or the NACC believe that. That's the whole problem. Only the super elites are privy enough to see the whole picture, how all the puzzle pieces fit together. The Department of Transportation can flat out deny that a NAFTA superhighway will ever be built. The Department of Homeland Security can talk about border enforcement and fencing, and they can do it all with a straight face because, as far as they know, they're right. It's plausible deniability at its finest. As with so many other problems we face, the solution can be found right in the Constitution, the very document the elites are trying to circumvent. And it's right in those first three magic words, we, the people. We have to demand accountability. We have to demand transparency from our leaders. We can't sit idle as private working groups form recommendations during secret meetings, and we can't stay silent when those recommendations turn into actions. A good example is the immigration bill proposed in spring of 2007. The Secure Borders, Economic Opportunity, and Immigration Reform Act of 2007. Love that name. It contained references to both the SPP and to something called the Partnership for Prosperity, which was a precursor to the SPP from 2001. The bill stated, "It is the sense of Congress that the United States and Mexico should accelerate the implementation of the Partnership for Prosperity." ADD moment. Sense of Congress? I mean, they like irony even more than I thought. I'll bet most elected representatives don't even know what the SPP or the Partnership for Prosperity is, let alone be willing to vote that it is their sense to accelerate it.
If supporters are really trying not to be covert about these programs, then why bury those references on page 231 of a 340-page piece of crap legislation that they know virtually no one will ever read? Fortunately, there is a surefire way to leverage our collective power and beat the elites at their own game. 1. Build 2 fences. One along the entire northern border and another one along the entire southern border. They should have double layers of fencing with roads in between for patrols, concrete vehicle barriers, surveillance cameras, and tunneling sensors. It would likely cost upward of $20 billion. If that sounds expensive, consider that 9/11 cost the city of New York alone at least $90 billion. Believe me, the fences are a bargain. Then again, the price tag, along with the calls of racism and claims that it wouldn't help anyway, are just misleading tactics that critics use. I'm not really interested in their propaganda anymore. If you haven't noticed, it hasn't gotten us anywhere. Not to mention, the critics have forgotten one of the key rules of real estate. Fences make good neighbors. 2. Hit the employers hard. Hard-working Mexicans come here for jobs and money. Those jobs, by the way, often involve work in substandard conditions for illegal wages. They are provided by American companies, and that must stop. It is modern-day slavery. By mandating that employers who are caught knowingly hiring illegal workers be hit with crippling fines, we would send a message to every business owner that it would no longer be tolerated. Once the supply is cut off, the demand will dry up. After those two things are done, and by done, I mean that the fence is built, not just included in some bill, then, and only then, can we talk about such things as amnesty, guest worker programs, or a path to citizenship. To commingle them is like picking out a new paint color for your kitchen while it's still flooding from a broken pipe. Fix the leak first. Stop the flow of water. Then worry about your paint color. The other benefit of building fences and fining employers is that those solutions are the kryptonite to the elite's power. The last thing they want are fences or stricter immigration policies. In fact, those very things would ruin the goals they've been working so very hard on for decades. After all, it's kind of tough to have a unified North American government with 7,000 miles of double-layered fencing in the way. Epilogue. One final note. I personally just want to thank you for listening every day, or watching the TV, or reading Fusion magazine, or trusting me enough with the, what is it, $25 that this CD costs. Thank you. I know that you are responsible for my success, and I am forever grateful. Thanks for listening. See you on TV, or hear you on the radio.
An Inconvenient Book, Real Solutions to the World's Biggest Problems, was written and read by Glenn Beck. It was abridged for audio by Trevi Johnson. The recording engineers were Dan Andros, Sarah Sullivan, and Noel Benford. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. It was mixed by Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Amory Klimchak. An Inconvenient Book was produced and directed by Karen DiMattia. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. An inconvenient book, Real Solutions to the World's Biggest Problems, is available in hardcover from Threshold. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Glenn Beck's The Real America, Messages from the Heart and Heartland, read by the author.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.